Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 386 of Registry Matters. Larry, Saturday again, what are you up to?
I'm enjoying another toasty weekend in the land of enchantment.
And toasty triple digits?
No, we're staying at around 97 to 99.
A stone's throw from. All right, well, do us a favor. It helps, you know, because everything this in this world these days is about algorithms. So when you press like and subscribe in your favorite podcast app, that feeds the algorithm and tells people that this program is worthwhile. And considering that there are, I don't know, call it 750 BFRs. Fair number, Larry?
750 or 750,000?
Well, 750,000. I figured that was people would understand that there was a K after it. Anyway, it would tell them that they could listen to this program too. And so, yeah. And then if you want to be generous, you can head over to Patreon because we have a couple dozen patrons listening to us live here recording on a Saturday night at 7:11 p.m. East Coast time, because that's the only time that matters. What are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a case from the North Carolina Supreme Court. And we have an update of another case pending in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. So this is North Carolina night. And we have, in that case, is a win, at least for the moment. And we have a question from a senior gentleman incarcerated in the state of South Dakota named Craig. And it came in at the last minute, and I threw it in here.
Very well. Well, let's begin there.
In Florida, one county let 39 businesses call themselves parks. A clothing store. Suddenly, almost 99% of housing is off limits. A new federal lawsuit takes that on, and it will take years. Registry Matters covers it all as a nonprofit, which means listeners fund the fight. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
And I hope to submit my commutation this coming week, so I can be paroled in less than 2 years. I've just learned the Department of Corrections requires us to attend 3 different sex offender classes once a week. They're referred to as therapy classes. I assume, and I'm hoping, Medicare or Medicaid will cover the $50 to $90 a week cost.
What is that?
So the first class is 12 weeks. That one's no cost and required along with a lie detector test in order to get out. The lie detector test costs $100 if paid before parole, but $325 if you don't have the money before parole. I'm sensing a money machine. The second class can be taken while still in prison, but it's 12 months long. I wish I knew that earlier. This is also weekly. You may recall my cellmate, 93-year-old Don, had to have his wife drive him 1 hour to Sioux Falls, South Dakota each week until he died. If you don't attend or are late, you risk being sent back to prison. Violator. And the third class, I have no information on. I can't trust my fellow inmates. Maybe they never got to number 3. Somewhere in the required courses, we are required to share with our fellow inmates our private and personal sexual experiences and fantasies. So I'm watching TV news, and a woman's $40 million was awarded TikTok violating the privacy laws. I don't even know how to read that. Now, as I grew up believing, what happens in your home is your business. I'm going to assume that since this is therapy, it's okay to share our experiences, fantasy, with non-professionals, as well as the instructors. Obviously, I haven't personally experienced this, but my roommates have. I personally believe this part of the course is an intrusion of our private lives. It just reeks of porn, so others can learn how to be more deviant. There's no other form of crime that I am aware of, maybe drugs or alcohol, that requires this level of intrusion. Are you aware of these courses?
No, I'm not aware specifically of South Dakota's courses, their structure there, but I do know that these are common things that happen. The treatment, I think we've referred to it through the years as a collaborative fishing expedition. Do you remember that term? I haven't used it in a while.
I think it's an incredibly good term.
That's what I've seen it as being. Now, with the exception of one state on the eastern seaboard that starts with an M that's midway up the Atlantic coast, they are pure wind-driven snow.
I'm trying to think of a state on the eastern seaboard that starts with an M. Drawing a blank. And pure as the wind-driven snow.
Yes, Maryland. Now, everything that goes on there is perfect with the best of intentions, but I don't know about this. The laugh track was because I'm doubting that Medicare or Medicaid will pay for this, but I'm not 100% sure. I know the states, the ones that believe the federal government's too large and too overreaching and too vast and enormous, those states are the first to put their paws out to get federal dollars. So I have heard that they can access Medicaid funding for people at some stage of their incarceration. As far as Medicare, I'm not sure that I've ever heard of it paying for anything while a person's incarcerated. But again, I don't know that. It's not a question. It comes up. But I wouldn't count on Medicare or Medicaid because while you're under incarceration, your Social Security has been suspended. And Medicare comes with age or blindness or disability, but I'm not sure if it's going to pay for that. So if I were Craig, I would be looking for other options, because if they don't cover it, then it's going to need to be covered according to his narrative. Would you agree with that? If you got to do it to get out.
Yeah, totally. If that's part of your, like, I don't know, check on the boxes to say that, so that you can get out, sounds like a thing that you'd have to do.
It does, but I'm asking our vast audience that stretches not only to the coast to coast, but even in international locations. I'm asking our vast audience to help us with these particular classes because the disclosures are quite common. They will ask you for a sexual history disclosure, and then they'll polygraph you against your answers. The problem is, a person that's 79 years old, they're not going to remember every sex episode they've ever had, unless they've only had one episode in their life. How are you going to remember that? How would you document all that?
And what I, like, there was a guy in one of my classes, and he just had, like, the instructor acknowledged that he had really crappy memory. So he's like, I can't trust that if you take a polygraph that you would even acknowledge remembering what you did. So I'm going to have you take a plethysmograph. I was like, what? Seriously? That's your alternative?
Now, for our audience, can you please enlighten us as to exactly how that test is conducted that you just mentioned, and what exactly it measures and the accuracy of that test?
Well, I can almost guarantee you the accuracy is going to be poopy caca, first of all. But as far as what it is, if you imagine that you go to the doctor and they put the blood pressure cuff on your arm, can you imagine going to another area that, under certain circumstances, may show an increase in blood pressure? Like, I mean, did that work? Did that work?
An increase in blood pressure. Let's see. What could that be?
And
what part,
of the
anatomy is that on?
I mean, let's just say it's male specific. And external plumbing specific. And it's about mid-region, roughly.
Okay, I think I'm getting the picture now. And it measures... So I think I've heard of that test. They stimulate you with visual images, and then they measure the reaction through that. What'd you call it again?
Blood pressure testing? Is that
the name of the device.
The plethysmograph?
How do you pronounce that?
Plethysmograph.
I can't even pronounce it. But anyway,
it's almost like plasma. It's almost like plasma graph, but then plethysma. I spend a lot of time. I was like, what is this stupid? What is this word? I had to look it up, and I was like, oh my God, they put the tiniest little blood pressure cuff known to man around your man junk and show you naughty pictures to see if you get aroused by, like, seriously? And what does that even prove? Okay, So let's just say hypothetically, Larry, that you are aroused by pictures of people that are under whatever age you want to pick. That does not mean you're going to act on it. So what does it prove?
Well, theoretically, I would guess it would prove that where they would need to direct their impulse control urges in the so-called treatment, if it were real treatment, that there could be some legitimate use of that device. But the problem we have in this system is that nothing is used legitimately. It's kind of like the GPS system. When the people devised that, that we could monitor offenders, they said, oh, we're going to be able to empty our prisons. We will be able to know where people are all the time, and we will be able to save a whole bunch of money. Well, that's not what happened. What happened was they just morphed the universe of people subject to that. Very few people got out of prison because of GPS monitoring that wouldn't have gotten out anyway. And everybody that's on pretrial supervision now, they have a whole apparatus that sprung up where when you're arrested, you're released on pretrial supervision, and guess what? You get a GPS monitoring. The prisons didn't become emptier. All they did is they created a new regime of supervision.
And revenue.
And I say the same thing about this, although it could be a useful device in the right circumstances.
So by comparison, let's say we take Jeffrey Dahmer and we show him pictures, find some way to measure this, and we show him pictures of doing terrible things to people. And does that mean the person's gonna do anything with that information? Or you show a drug addict, you show them drug stuff after they've been clean, and that's going to prove that they're going to relapse?
It doesn't prove they're going to relapse, but it would help you with creating an impulse control barrier around the individual. We know you've got urges in that area. If we were really trying to treat you and prevent recidivism, if that were really the goal here, rather than collectively trying to put you back into prison, we would help you with treatment. It's like kind of like the guy that came to a class and said, I just can't help myself. When I drive home past the park, I cast my eyes at the people in the park. And of course, many of them at that particular park were minors. And he called the probation department. I said, don't call that emergency number. I said, the last thing you're going to do is end up with a ticket to jail if you call that number. Do not call that number. Whatever you do, do not call that number. And he called it because he thought it was a help number. And it helped him, all right.
I have urges. And they immediately put him in someplace safe and secure, right?
That's exactly what they did. But if it were real treatment, they would have said, okay, let's deal with those urges. What are you thinking?
Generally treatment goes.
That is not how it works.
If you were having private treatment that you selected the treatment provider and it was one-on-one, that it would be a very different situation. But sitting in a classroom with 12 of your best friends, no, that is not what this is about.
Nope, it is not. And the sooner we realize that the society is getting taken, but they don't care. That's what I tell people when they say that we're going to save a bunch of money. Got a guy up in Colorado that's trying to get a bunch of PFRs off the registry. I said, what's your strongest argument? He's going to save money. I said, that doesn't do anything. Keep going. What else do you have?
Right.
So,
okay. Are you completely familiar with the laws and all that stuff in South Dakota?
No, but I'm appealing to the audience. If there's anybody can provide any help, shoot us a text, not a text, but an email to what you'll give out later, and let us know, or make a phone call, and we'll pass it on to the guy. I'm actually in communication with him regularly, and I'll pass on any information that's reliable.
Yeah, of course. Very well.
Cameras on your street photograph every car that passes, and a private company owns the pictures. Police have used those systems to hunt people by status and by protest. Larry explains why nobody ever voted for any of it. Patrons get the show early, ad-free, plus bonus material the public feed never hears. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
All right, well then, so let's cover this North Carolina church case. Very good?
Sounds good.
All right, well then, on October 6th, 2025, so what, about 9 months ago, Reese's Chapel Missionary Baptist Church, so we'll just call it Reese's Chapel from now on, and John Doe, so we'll just call him Doe, collectively plaintiffs, filed a complaint against ASA, ASA? Which way do you want to go with that one?
I'll take ASA for Southern.
Okay. ASA Buck, in his official capacity as sheriff of Carteret County, North Carolina. That was a mouthful. So what is this about?
This action arises from Doe's desire to attend religious services at the Reese's Chapel Worship Hall, which is within 300 feet of areas used by minors. North Carolina, the state of freedom, restricts such attendance by registered offenders who commit an offense against a minor. The plaintiffs, now this is what I've been dreaming for, a church that actually wants the person to be with them. The plaintiffs assert three claims under 42 United States Code, Section 1983, and the First Amendment. They cite a freedom of speech, count one, free exercise of religion, count two, and the right to associate, count three. And I'm loving it. I wish Narsold had the case, but unfortunately it got referred out mistakenly, and it's been handled by another entity. But this is what I've been dreaming for.
Now I just want to like chime in because, you know, my legal prowess here is going to shine. Isn't a 1983 claim like a constitutional claim?
Yes, that's how you seek redress in the federal court system.
And like that's a big deal, right?
Well, it is, because it's going to pay attorney's fees when the final decision against the county is made, and they're going to have to pony up, and they'll laugh about it and keep doing what they're doing.
Now, but this is also the state that did something similar-ish with Packingham, with the First Amendment claim and the guy on Facebook.
That is correct.
Okay, so they're taking another swing at it.
This is the state that believes in individual freedom. I keep harping on that because the people who vote for these folks, they claim to be freedom lovers, but yet they vote for people who take their freedoms away.
All right. Set this up. January 13th, 2026, Buck moved to dismiss the complaint for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and for failure to state a claim and filed a memorandum in support. On March 7th, 2026, plaintiffs responded in opposition. Dum, dum, dum. What happened next?
Well, the court denied Buck's motion to dismiss the complaint. Reese's Chapel is a religious organization that offers religious services in Newport, North Carolina. Reese's Chapel has a small play area and an area used for religious education of minors within 300 feet of its worship hall. Buck considers the Reese's Chapel Worship Hall off limits under Section 14-208 of the PFR Act, and has stated, he reminds me of the sheriff over in Georgia with the gal that had oral sex with her when she was in high school. You remember that one?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, I'll do one. I'll put my hand like Bible. Well, this reminds me of that one. He stated that, quote, he will arrest any person subject to the statute, covered person, for being present at Reese's Chapel for any purpose. Now, that's my kind of sheriff.
Very well. All right. The plaintiffs allege that Reese's Chapel's core activities are worship, teaching, and evangelizing, that these activities are inherently expressive, that Reese's Chapel and its members, like Doe, presently seek to associate for the express purpose of these activities, and that the challenged statutes severely burden their ability to associate and engage in these activities. The First Amendment, excuse me, what is CID? I don't know what that means.
No, that shouldn't have been there. It's basically a citation that I didn't take out.
God, see, I asked you if there were any traps, and you said no. Anyway, the First Amendment guarantees all Americans the rights to speak, worship, publish, assemble, and petition their government freely. And each of these rights necessarily carries with it a corresponding right to associate with others. This would seem to be the type of activity a core conservative would support. Like, we're all about some constitutional, damn it, right?
Well, it would be, except for, you remember we got a little hypocrisy clip.
I have one. Oh my God, I gotta find it.
That's all right.
For you to come back and call bigots my admirers is a farce, it's a act of hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
But again, I'm just keep begging the audience, why don't you call these people out on that? These are the things that they claim they're for. But government actions tending to curtail the freedom to associate warrant the closest scrutiny of the First Amendment. The judge stated, quote, thus, the court denies Buck's motion to dismiss count three for failure to state a claim. And sum, the court denies defendant's motion to dismiss plaintiff's complaint for lack of subject matter jurisdiction or failure to state a claim. So, guess what, Buck? You got to defend this now.
Does the buck stop here? Sorry, I couldn't resist that one.
It will stop when that he's crushed, and we will probably never have this table set the same way again with a church after what happened in the South Carolina church that we've been wanting to cover, but we haven't gotten quite ready to be there. But after they arrested everybody that was running the church and filed unconstitutional charges against them, we'll probably never have another church do this. But this was my dream, and it's going to be successful, folks. It's going to win.
And to restate that, because I don't think we covered that, this is a church that is actually saying they welcome at least this PFR into their church. They're actually kind of like standing up for the PFR.
Well, they joined the complaint. I think there's a relationship between I think it's a son or something. But anyway, this is what we needed, folks. And we finally got a church that said we wanted it. Ain't none of your business who's in our congregation.
And they will just lose this one. Yes.
I don't see any way they can turn this ship around. They shot everything that they filed. They will file again. You know, making the same arguments that they made in the motion to dismiss. But briefing on this, you really don't need. This is one of those where you're not going to hear me complain about it not going to trial. There's no trial needed on this. This is actually a good case for summary judgment.
Oh, but would it be at all beneficial to take it to court? Would there be something more to gain from it?
I'd have to really look at it more carefully, but I can't see any need. There's no record needing to be developed.
Okay.
All the facts are straightforward. We know the dimensions of the building. We know how far the offending property is that causes the church to be interfered with. And we know the separation of church and state is already there. We know it's none of the damn government's business about who's in the church pews. We already know this stuff. We don't need to develop the record here.
I gotcha. And then no matter what, the decision at the end of it would then be able to be used elsewhere?
Absolutely, because Buck might be like...
Because it's a 1983 claim, right?
Well, it would not have any jurisdiction outside of that federal district, but he is going to appeal if he's anything like the Butts County Sheriff in Georgia. Because he's just the name and the way he's coming across when I did my analysis of the complaint. He's one of those hard heads he'll have to be taught a lesson, and he'll probably never learn even after he loses. He'll just say the Coates messed him up is what he'll say. Those federal judges appointed for life are taking over his state, and he don't like it, and that's why he needs to be in office. That's what he'll say.
And they will say, thank you, Sheriff Buck, for keeping us safe.
That's exactly what will happen. They'll vote for him in a landslide is what they'll do.
Just like Buck. And maybe we could capture him saying, I'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court. And we could have them overlaid on top of each other saying what Gary Long said. And then this guy saying, we could have them in harmony saying the same thing.
A registered cook sent out 40 applications. Then his probation officer decided restaurants hire teenagers, which quietly made every kitchen in California off limits. Larry explains why that reading goes way past what the statute actually says. At higher patron levels, you can even get one-on-one time with Larry yourself. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
Very well. All right. Well, then, so here we are. We have this case from North Carolina Supreme Court. The case is State of North Carolina versus William David Lingerfelt. And this sounds like a criminal case.
It is. What was your first clue?
It's the state of North Carolina that they're suing. They're the prosecutor or whatever. Defendant? Wait, I don't know. It's pretty difficult, but the name gave me a clue, I guess. So why are we using FYP's valuable time for this? Now I've read it and I was pressure washing dog poo from underneath my lawnmower while I was reading it, but it doesn't seem like it's a win to me.
It's not. Do we only discuss successful cases here at FYP?
Generally, since you're Mr. Doom and Gloom, but we prefer to. So tell us what this case is about.
Well, a divided panel on the North Carolina Court of Appeals affirmed an order denying Lingerfelt's petition for termination of his duty to register. The order denying his removal petition was entered on May 22, 2023 by Judge Thomas Davis in Superior Court of McDowell County. So that's the what this case is about. He would like to get off the registry. Can you imagine that?
Weird. We have some people that try to go and register to stay on the registry, but there we also have people that try to get off, especially in North Carolina. Isn't that where we talked about the guy that went to the office three times?
Yep, that's where it happened at.
Why does everything happen in North Carolina? All right, let me set this up. In 2003, defendant William David Lingerfelt pleaded guilty to two counts of sexual activity by a substitute parent. As a result, Lingerfelt was required to register under North Carolina law. When can a PFR request removal in North Carolina?
Well, under state law in North Carolina, a person cannot petition to be removed from the PFR list until they meet the requirements of the Federal Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, known as SORNA. And under SORNA, offenders convicted of a Tier 1 offense cannot petition for removal until after 15 years. And those convicted of Tier 2 offenses must wait 25 years before seeking removal. Now, let me just clarify, because I did a cut and paste job. The Tier 1 is not exactly correct. It's 15 years base, but there's a provision for 5 years earlier if they've had no arrests, they've completed treatment and several things. So you can actually apply at year 10 after completion of 10 years. So that's what's going on here. And then now, this next line is yours right here.
That's fine. I just wanted to ask you a quick question. Are we going to... what tier is Lingerfelt?
He is a Tier 2. He had sought removal in 2019, but the trial court denied the petition after determining that Lingerfelt was a Tier 2 offender, meaning that he had to wait 25 years from his initial 2003 registration to seek removal. Very critical here. Listen, Lingerfelt did not appeal this ruling, although it was a final appealable judgment, but he chose not to appeal it, and it makes a big difference in how this case goes.
I do want to ask you a quick question about tiers versus levels. So tiers, that's the one that's based on your crime, not based on your category, like an evaluation, or am I doing that backwards?
No, you've got it correct. The tiers is, that's terminology related entirely in the Adam Walsh Act of 2006. And a number of states prior to the Adam Walsh Act had individualized assessments where they gave people risk levels. Arkansas did, a whole bunch of states did, and Nebraska did. And the federal government said, no, we'd prefer that we base it on the severity of the offense. So when you hear the term tier, it's talking about a categorical tie-in, what you've done and how it aligns in the criteria. When you're talking about a level, you're usually talking about you've gone through that test that you just described. They sent you over to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and they use that device actually in Pine Bluff from time to time. And they've analyzed your risk, and risk can change over time, but a tier cannot.
Gotcha. All right. So then to go back to Lingerfelt, a person can petition for removal after 15 years unless their tier designation requires a longer period of time. Did I explain that right?
You did. Correct. But the problem is that North Carolina law is very contradictory. They can request removal after 10 years, yet the General Assembly attached their removal process to federal law. His offense is a Tier 2 under federal law, thus he cannot be removed until he has been registered for a minimum of 25 years required under federal law.
Actually, this is true. You are making my head spin. So you have insisted for years that the states control registration. Now, all of a sudden, you say he can't be removed because of federal law? Can you help me kind of like square that around?
I was afraid you were going to ask me to do that.
Oh, yeah. You got me like,
So this ought to get Big Mike excited because this is good stuff. I can explain. The states do control it until such time as they decide to defer the control to the big, bad federal government. North Carolina chose to do that. Under Section 14-208.12a, the state has decided that the federal government is in control. It reads in pertinent part, the court may grant the relief if, one, the petitioner demonstrates to a culprit that he or she has not been arrested for any crime that would require registration on this article since completing the sentence, or two, the requested relief complies with the provisions of the Federal Jacob Wetterling Act as amended and any other federal standards applicable to termination of a registration requirement are required to be met as a condition of receipt of federal funds by the state. So they want that money, you know, from the government that's too big and too bloated. They want that money, so they decided to put into their statutory scheme, of course, it keeps the bloated registry alive, which justifies funding for all the units of law enforcement are doing that. Remember, these are the people trying to keep the government small and taxes low, right? But yeah, that's what they've done here. They've handed that control off to the federal government by statute.
Now I have an observation that I need to make here. So are you ready? Can I be honest with you for a second?
Sure.
You should have been a lawyer because you can rationalize anything regardless of how nonsensical it is.
Well, I'm not rationalizing it at all. It's the people of North Carolina that made the law. Don't blame me or the courts.
Okay, then. Let's move on. Lingerfeld did not give up. In 2023, he petitioned again to be removed from the registry. The trial court again denied the petition because he was a Tier 2 offender and not yet eligible. This time, though, Lingerfeld appealed, arguing that he was a Tier 1 offender, not a Tier 2 offender, and thus was eligible to be removed under SORNA. What was his basis then, Larry? What was his basis for claiming to be a Tier 1?
Well, in my opinion, he is properly a Tier 2 under federal criteria. So I'd say he's either crazy or he doesn't understand that tiers are categories based on your offense and they are static. They do not morph over time. You don't become a Tier 3. Well, you can if you commit another Tier 2 offense while you're a Tier 2 offender, but you don't morph if you don't commit any more crimes. You don't morph down or up. You are what you are unless the laws change.
We should say that you is what you is.
So, but
is that what the court actually then said?
No, they didn't actually say that. That's me saying that. They said that the dispositive question for the court is whether the failure to appeal the 2019 order bars Lingerfeld from contesting the legal ruling that he is a Tier 2 offender. As explained below, we hold that successive petitions to terminate sex offender registration are all parts of the same underlying case and subject to the doctrine of the law of the case.
I hear the words and I understand the words. I literally don't understand what these words are saying. But they went on to say, applying that doctrine here, Lingerfeld is procedurally barred from challenging his designation as a Tier 2 offender because he failed to appeal from the first judgment in this case addressing that legal question. As a result, the trial court properly denied his successive petition. We therefore modify and affirm the Court of Appeals' decision on this basis without addressing the remainder of the court's analysis. Now, does that mean he might have had a chance had he appealed the 2019 order?
Not in my opinion, because I think he is rightfully a Tier 2 offender. To be a Tier 1 offender, you have to have committed an offense that carries a maximum potential exposure of less than a year. If it goes over a year, it's automatically defaulted to Tier 2.
I see.
Well, those are generally misdemeanors. And there are not that many misdemeanor sexual offenses. And then the misdemeanor exception, there's a misdemeanor exception in the Adam Walsh Act if it's an offense targeted against a minor. Well, so even if it were a misdemeanor, which I didn't do the research, and I don't know if it is, but even if it were a misdemeanor, it sounds like to me it was against a minor. So he would be properly a Tier 2. So he's either crazy or he doesn't understand.
Well, you're piling on more confusion as we go, but that's okay. I'll take that on myself here. So, but then on page 6, it says, importantly, the registration statute expressly anticipates successive petitions to terminate registration. Following the denial of a petition, the offender may again petition the court for relief 1 year from the date of the denial of the original petition to terminate the registration requirement. So if the law permits successive petitions, how can they say that he should have appealed the original denial?
Well, it's easy, and they explain that. They said the one-year refiling provision advances the statute's purpose because the ultimate decision to grant a petition to terminate registration in that scenario turns on whether the trial court is satisfied that the petitioner is not a current potential threat to the public safety, meaning the court is sitting in as a mini tribunal looking at how risky you are, how much treatment you've got. If the offender is unable to persuade the court on that issue, the statute provides a one-year period which the offender can make life changes that might address the court's concerns. That's a whole separate thing than what we're dealing with here. He's trying to say the law didn't categorize him correctly. He's not a tier two. Being removed from the registry for merit is a different analysis. It's, are you a threat to the community? So I don't see any conflict at all.
That's a bunch of hogwash.
No, it's not hogwash. Where do you get the idea it's hogwash?
Tell me what they went on to say.
Well, they went on to say it follows then that a trial court's ruling on whether an offender is a threat to public safety is not subject to issue preclusion, which is what this was. That issue was precluded because it was the law of the case. You know, if you applied the law of the case doctrine to removal petitions, once you'd been denied, you'd never be able to get off. So there's no issue preclusion there. The General Assembly intended to give PFRs the ability to return to court after at least 1 year has passed and, in effect, seek reconsideration of the trial court's early determination that the offender is a threat to public safety. Because this is discretionary, fact-based determination is, by its nature, a matter over which reasonable jurists could reach different results. An early termination denial does not bar a court from reaching a different determination in the future, even if they're on large identical facts. It's perfectly logical, in my opinion.
So, and you can say all of this and keep a straight face and say that this is logical?
I can.
Okay.
Why would I not be able to? They explain the difference. But the same is not true for the determination of offender's tier level under SORTA. Unlike determining whether an offender is a threat to public safety, calculating the offender's tier level under SORTA is a legal question with only one objectively correct answer. And they cited Stone versus Moore, M-O-I-R, a 2016 decision from the North Carolina Supreme Court.
More hogwash!
You're on the warpath tonight with this hogwash, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yes, because this is poppycock.
You sounded like the Narsal paralegal when he read this.
Yes.
And they further explained it. They said, in the American legal system, we do not tolerate conflicting answers to pure legal questions. One of the principal reasons we have appellate courts is to prevent divergent development of legal issues by creating a system that can establish a single precedential answer. Applying this principle here, the trial court's calculation of Lingerfeld's tier level under SORTA is subject to issue preclusion. It's not possible for the trial court to correctly rule that Lingerfeld is a tier two offender in one petition, but a tier one offender in a successive petition. You see, can you not see that logic? You can't do what he's wanting to do.
And you believe this is nonsense?
I believe it because it makes sense.
To you?
God. They eloquently explained it. They said, this is a legal question, so one of two rulings is a legal error. Can you agree with that? If it's a legal question, there can't be but one answer.
No. You could take 10 attorneys into a room and ask them a question, and you're going to get 50 answers.
But this is black letter law. They looked at the Adam Walsh Act, and they said, this is a tier two. You can look at it 400 different ways. It's still a tier two. If Lingerfeld believed the trial court's first ruling was an error, he was required to appeal that ruling to avoid its preclusive effect in future petitions. He cannot accept the ruling, decline to appeal, and then insist that a future court can rule a different way on the same question of law. And they cited Callaway versus Ford Motor Company from way back in 1972.
All right. Well, let me read what they said on page 11. It says, in sum, Lingerfeld's 2023 petition for removal from the registry was barred by law of the case. In 2019, the trial court entered a final appealable order ruling that Lingerfeld was a Tier 2 offender not eligible for removal from the registry until 25 years after his initial 2003 registration. Lingerfelt did not appeal that order, rendering it the law of the case. See Summers 351 North Carolina at 622. As a result, that ruling cannot be challenged in a successive termination petition because that petition is part of subsequent proceedings in the same case. I am confused because I read that the state did not raise the law of the case doctrine during the appeal.
Yes, and I was confused about that too, but I went digging and the court stated, we acknowledge that the state did not assert the law of the case argument at the Court of Appeals. Because the state failed to do so, Lingerfelt insists that the argument is abandoned before this court. This is incorrect because the state is the appellee. Appellate review of a lower court ruling is strictly limited to the arguments presented by the appellant, absent certain unwaivable issues such as subject matter jurisdiction, which you've heard me pontificate. You can't waive that. It is not the role of the appellate courts to create an appeal for an appellant. As a result, an appellate court will only review the issues the appellant presents to it, even if there appear to be other unraised grounds that render the lower judgment infirm. But this principle does not apply to arguments of the appellee. A reviewing court is not constrained to uphold a lower court ruling solely on legal grounds presented by the appellee. Were it otherwise, it would compel an appellate court to reverse a judgment that's legally sound, in effect permitting litigants to stipulate what the law is and the result permitting them to force an appellate court to invalidate a proper trial court judgment. We do not allow this. End of quote. They explained it, why they couldn't do that.
And ultimately he's SOL?
Well, he's close to the 25-year mark, so he's not SOL, but he is until he reaches that mark, which I think comes in 2028 if you add 25 to 2003. And then if they don't count the time he was in prison or on probation, it may be longer, but he's getting closer.
I do know that you generally don't care for dissenting opinions, and you don't really consider them very relevant, but I noticed that on page 10, they stated the majority reasons that the successive petitions are all part of the same case, therefore the issue of tier level is precluded by an earlier court's determination, and the law of the case doctrine applies to that issue. To the contrary, both Lingerfelt and the state essentially argue that the law of the case doctrine is preempted by the fact that the General Assembly has expressly allowed defendants to file a new petition to terminate their registration from PFR registration 1 year from a denied petition. Furthermore, both point to an absence in the statute of any language that suggests that rulings in earlier petition proceedings bind subsequent petition proceedings, regardless of under which prong an earlier petition is denied. I am inclined to agree, you know, me and my great legal mind here agree that the state and Mr. Lingerfelt reading of the statute. Do you think that this will carry any weight and it's significant?
No, because it's not logical. They're
more hogwash.
They're comparing apples and oranges. He didn't appeal the key issue of tier level when he should have. He can go back every year for eternity once he's got this 25 years in, and he can keep making the arguments he should get off the PFR list. But he cannot change his tier designation now because he couldn't have changed it anyway because he would have lost. But this is a legally sound ruling. I don't know why you're having such trouble with it.
Probably because I have like dead brain, I suppose. All right. Well, as usual, Larry, you're pretty hopeless. The dissent concluded as follows. I would defer to the statute as written by the legislature and hold that the law of the case doctrine does not apply because each petition is a new proceeding and the prior adjudication is non-binding. Even if the law of the case doctrine did apply, it is an assertion that the state waived an appeal and neither party raised it in its supplemental briefings. Because the majority's holding clearly contravenes the statute, I respectfully dissent.
And another justice joined. Two justices joined the dissent, but the court has seven members, and they needed to convince two more, and they failed because their arguments are not sound. They're grasping for straws.
So you're then saying that those two justices who've done all their time in law school and judging and all that stuff, you're saying that they're, well, I don't know, not competent or something?
I wouldn't go that far. I would say that they have the desire to look beyond the law. And what if we call that legislating from the bench, right?
I believe so, yes. And we like that.
Well, we do, but it suits our purposes. But they looked at the law. North Carolina clearly wanted the PFR registry not to have people exit that would be considered an offender under federal law. If you don't like that, folks, change your government in North Carolina. It's not for the courts to determine that Mr. Lingenfelt should not be a registrant. The people of North Carolina determined that he is, and he's got to wait 25 years with whatever time that they don't count. I don't think they count all the time. I think incarceration and supervision may not count. But he's got to wait until the people have allowed him the opportunity to get off.
Very well. Yeah. Okay.
You don't believe in legislating from the bench, really, do you?
When I wanted to, I do. Yeah.
Well, that's what this program exists for. We all believe in legislating from the bench. I'm just being consistent, saying, hey, if you like it in some scenarios, you should like it in more scenarios. And people like it when it suits their purposes. I like it when I win.
Sure. You like summary judgment when it works.
And this is a good case for that.
So, I gotcha.
And we've got some new patrons, a returning patron, and a new patron. It came in at stimulus level.
Pretty close to it. Yes.
Kevin and Charles.
Thank you. Jeepers. I sent that to you today. Thank you very much, Kevin. That was incredibly generous, and welcome back, Charles. Charles is a former longtime patron from across the pond.
Charles is a very nice individual. I'm glad to have him back with us. Is he listening tonight? Is he on with us?
I do not know. I don't think so. No, I don't think he's here. No.
So.
Anything else? You know, we're at 45 minutes. I'll give you 5 minutes of soapboxing.
No, we've done enough. I want to get out of this hot box.
Very well. Head over to Registry Matters to get show notes and links everywhere you need to go. You can email at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Leave old-fashioned voicemail messages at 747-227-4477. And please, very kindly and very generously, support us over at patreon.com/registrymatters. You can join us on a Discord server. There's a link in every page to get you over there. And then if you want some cool swag, we did talk about the Kabuki machine, and I missed my chance to reference the Kabuki machine. But we have a very cool Kabuki machine shirt that you can almost see it over there on my shoulder there. So anyway, but that's at fypeducation.org/shop. And you can get some cool merch there. That's all I got, my friend.
Well, we'll see you tomorrow morning at 7.
Please don't do that. I hope you have a good night. Stay warm, or cool. I shouldn't say warm. Stay cool, and I hope you have a good rest of your weekend. I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.